from the Mutual Broadcasting System. This is STRAT, Strategic Risk Assessment Talk. Now, retired Marine Intelligence Officer and globally recognized risk expert, Hal Kempfer.
Hi, welcome to STRAT. This is Hal Kempfer, Strategic Risk Assessment Talk. There's a lot of stuff going on in the world, but I am going to focus on something that I think a lot of people aren't looking at that closely, and that's what's happening in Russia. And, well, I should say Russia and Ukraine. And there's something happening in an area that gets quite a bit of coverage, which is Eastern Ukraine or the Donbas area, which was a big focus of that, you know, the talks that they had in Alaska, or what came out of the talks in Alaska between Putin and Trump, and the idea of some sort of land swap thing or real estate deal, whatever it is. Anyway, I'm going to talk about that because there's something going on here, which I think in the coming weeks could become a big issue in this war. All right. And I'm going to talk about Putin's inherent dilemma. I'm going to talk about what Russia's doing. And I'm going to talk about a little bit of history of what Russia's been doing. And then I'm going to talk about this key moment. And this is something that anyone who studied, you know, Clausewitz, Karl von Clausewitz, or, you know, Napoleonic war philosophy or something like that, it's something called the decisive battle. And it appears that something like that could be coming very, very soon. Not guaranteed. In fact, historically, you can never guarantee that a decisive battle will actually be decisive before the battle takes place, but just seeing a lot of factors compound. So let me get into this, all right? Let me talk about some of the history here, some of the things going on. Why did Russia invade Ukraine in February 2022? You know, why did it invade Crimea with its little green men and the Donbas, Eastern Ukraine, in 2014? Why did it invade Georgia in 2008? In short, Russia was sputtering economically. It really wasn't going anywhere. Economically, it wasn't dead in the water, but it just wasn't really moving very fast. And with the increasingly oppressive regime, autocratic system that was being put in place by, you know, a Soviet apparatchik, if you will, Vladimir Putin, what he was putting in place was losing whatever dynamism it had coming out of the Cold War and the 90s and the early 00s. Was really starting to sputter out. So he needed to do something. And since he just didn't have the wherewithal to fix things internally, unless he just did stuff that was completely against his very nature, he decided that it's time to externalize what he couldn't fix internally. And historically, externalizing can have a lot of means. I mean, in time immemorial, autocratic and somewhat desperate national leaders who can't effectively manage their country or empire, especially their national or imperial economy or whatever you want to call it, an economy, in order to be vibrant and growing, needs to have some things. You know, you have to have innovation, right? Yeah, you have to have a certain amount of autonomous decision-making throughout the economy. It has to be an economy that can absorb a certain amount of risk in terms of investments, things like that. It needs to have freedom of action in a disseminated way amongst the business leadership. It needs to be flexible. It has to have a whole host of characteristics that folks like Vladimir Putin absolutely detest. They hate that. They want to control a controlled economy. They like a command economy where the head of the state determines what the rest of the country is going to do. That's what he's comfortable doing, right? And that's not what the Russia that he was designing. And not surprisingly, Russia's level of innovation and everything else was starting to sputter out pretty darn fast. So he couldn't fix that. So he looked for the traditional shortcut, which is try to externalize all that frustration that's building in the country. Go focus on a foreign foe, another country. Go get a victory overseas and then bring it back home and say, look what I did. And he did that with Georgia in 2008 when Ukraine basically tossed out their Russian lackey president and basically ushered in true democracy in 2013-14 time period. Well, that's when he decided it was time to go in, and he took Crimea, which is kind of the crown jewel, if you will, of what Russia wanted there, and also put forces in the Donbas. And then as the Russian economy again was sputtering, really not being able to come out in any considerable way from the pandemic. That just, it wasn't going anywhere. I'm sure that somewhere he was getting some briefings that was saying this is what's going on. And he was looking at this going, I'm not going to stay in power if I can't get things moving. That's when he decided, okay, now's the big time. Let's go for this maximalist goal of regaining Ukraine. And then, of course, after that, he'd want to regain the Baltic states, Estonia, Latvia, Lithuania, probably want to solidify the deal and claim Belarusia. And then he'd probably look to Central Asia after that. That certainly was what he was thinking, but it just has not quite worked out the way he wanted, right? That was what he wanted. Now, this is a time-proven thing. Empires going back, large countries, empires, nation states, whatever you want to call them. If you look at the Roman Empire, their empire was built on conquest. They would go and take over a neighboring state or neighboring country or neighboring tribal area or whatever it was, and they built this massive empire in basically around the Mediterranean and up into Europe, going all the way, well, frankly, all the way up to Scotland at one point. So it was big. But once they lacked the wherewithal to keep growing, once it lacked that dynamism within the economy, once they couldn't conquest the stuff, the internal problems within the Roman state really started to cause some real issues, and they started shrinking. And now I'm not going to tell you the Western Roman Empire kind of shrank and disappeared, if you will, due to a lot of these internal issues. I'm not going to take away the effects of natural disaster, but I will say the Russian Empire and certainly the plague of Justinian, that was caused by something that was actually much bigger than that, that was not just that macroeconomic. But Putin does not understand market capitalism. He doesn't understand macroeconomics the way anybody else understands macroeconomics. He understands command economics. And he doesn't seem, but I'll tell you what he does seem to understand is he understands the tools of corruption, subversion, and in a broad sense, kind of military adventurism politically. I don't think he really understands the operational tactical issues involved. Doesn't really seem to have a strategic mindset in that as well. His decisions and actions in these areas have just shown a fundamental incompetence that he's shown consistently. He's able to maintain this through subversion, coercion, corruption, whatever. He's managed to maintain his position as the head of the Russian state, the Russian country. But when you look at some of his military misadventures, you look at it and you go, yeah, that's just not panning out for the guy. And it's not working. In fact, he's looking at some big problems because in doing what he's done in Ukraine, he's really opened himself up in some other areas. He grossly underestimated the power and the pull of nationalism. He did not understand fundamentally Ukrainian nationalism. I don't think he understands the nationalism of Estonia, Latvia, Lithuania, or a number of other countries either. I just don't think he really understands that. And this is just like Gorbachev. I don't think Gorbachev really understood the power of nationalism in some of these Soviet, what used to be Soviet republics. And he miscalculated how much and how long it would take to conquer Ukraine. I think he thought he was going to roll into Ukraine. In fact, many have said his plan was to take it over within about 3 weeks. I just don't think he understood what he was getting into there. I'd argue that the most he could have accomplished if his forces hadn't literally ran out of gas and all the tires on the vehicles went flat right after they entered into the country, if he hadn't had this massive maintenance, logistical, operational breakdown of his forces, he might have managed to get Russia embroiled in a military quagmire like Vietnam was for us. Or he could have got Russia embroiled in a quagmire, a far, far larger quagmire than what the Soviet Union experienced in Afghanistan in the 1980s. But with that said, he didn't get there. Anyway, now Putin has essentially, because of what he's done, lost his most significant foreign markets. He's got India and China buying a lot of oil. But if those secondary sanctions are put in, if the European Union mirrors what the U.S. is doing, what Secretary of Treasury Bessent was talking about, that they also put on crippling secondary sanctions at the same time the U.S. does, that could cause huge problems. Late Senator John McCain used to say that Russia is basically a big gas station. And it is. When you look at Russia from an economic standpoint, they're kind of like a freaking petrostate. They rely on oil and gas sales and, to a lesser extent, critical mineral sales overseas to basically fund the economy. It is not a powerhouse of manufacturing. It's not a powerhouse of technology. It's not a powerhouse of industrial might. It is a big oil field, gas and oil field, and that's what they really do on a macro level. And then they do a lot of mining. because they had a lot of space, but they don't do all those other things. They are not the Soviet Union. Soviet Union was an industrial powerhouse, not a well-oiled, well-aligned industrial powerhouse, which eventually was one of the big reasons they literally just fell apart because of their command economic model, and it just didn't fit. But they had a lot of industrial might. He doesn't have that with Russia, and I think he kind of understood that they weren't getting that anytime soon, hence his folly of going on this little foreign adventure, if you will. His implicitly autocratic impulses have also made him not only a horrible strategic decision maker, but I would venture to guess, which is kind of strange because he's an intelligence officer, he's a lousy intelligence officer. You know, a really good senior intelligence officer listens to viewpoints that dissent against the norm. In fact, if you're a good intelligence officer, particularly a senior intelligence officer, one of the things you absolutely have to do is you have to basically tell truth to power. You know, when things aren't going well, it's up to you to say, hey, look, boss, I know you want to do this, but this is the reasons why it won't work, or these are some of the things you need to consider that do not bode well for where we're going. I don't think he has that. I think what he's done is he's surrounded himself with a lot of like-minded individuals. They tell him what he wants to hear. And certainly he wanted to hear that his big investment in Russian military hardware, you know, all this stuff that he'd done to rebuild the Russian military to its former might, all these things he did prior to February 2022, that all of that was working out great, that the fundamental problems of the Russian army in terms of leadership, training, personnel, equipment, all that stuff was a thing of the past, and they were ready to go. I think he wanted to hear that. I think there were people who surrounded him who were more than willing to tell him that, and I think he paid a huge price for it. All right. I think he wanted to hear how Europe was so dependent on Russian oil and gas that they would sit by and do nothing, just like they did in 2008 with Georgia, just like they did in 2014 with Crimea and the Donbass, that they would do nothing. He wanted to hear that as well, and he did. And of course, he paid a massive price for that. So I think fundamentally, he just doesn't have what it takes to understand this stuff, to assess this stuff. He has created his own little bubble. He loves to use disinformation, obfuscation, and misdirection as a tool, but he's done that to himself. He's created a bubble around him where disinformation, obfuscation, misdirection, all this stuff is what he probably gets a lot of in terms of feedback. I don't think he gets as really good ground truth, which again is surprising because his background is he's an intelligence officer. He should be getting, they should know better. But I think that whatever skills he had, those have languished and atrophied over time, and he's just become somewhat complacent in power, if you will, and that's what it is. Now, here's the bottom line. Despite what disinformation is put out by Russia, they are not really winning this war. Putin thinks you're winning the war. Those around Putin want to think he's winning the war, but he's not winning the war. They're moving really, really slow. They're making very marginal gains of terrain at enormous costs of personnel and equipment. Whereas, you know, people say Russia's famous, they have an endless amount of people and stuff like that. That Russia is not the Russia of today. The Russia today has a vastly diminishing birth rate. Its population is actually shrinking because of its extremely low birth rate. The population that is in there now, those 18 to 35 year old men that are 18 to 30, I should say, you know, that prime group that military age males, he's wiping them out. He's taken out almost 1.1 million, have been. Most of them, I believe, are dead. A lot of them were killed in action. Many of the wounded are maimed and disabled and falling back on a society that doesn't do a very good job taking care of its maimed and disabled. And when it comes to mental things like PTSD, don't even think the Russians care about dealing with those individuals. They've taken out this huge amount, and there's not a lot of male population that's going to replace them that's coming into the age group of 18 to the early 20s. That is a smaller group because of the decreasing demographic realities of Russian society. So this is having an impact. Russia is not the Soviet Union. They've got less than 170 million people. I think it's somewhere around mid-160s is where they're at. And they have been pulling heavily from the non-ethnic Russian groups, which that also leads to the seeds of discontent. You know, if you're in a village where you've sent your military age males off to war and none of them come back, and so you don't have anybody to take over the farm, take over the store, t- take over anything in that village. You basically lost a generation, kind of like what happened in Britain after World War One. You know, a lot of those British villages literally just collapsed after, or English villages certainly collapsed after World War One. And they never were the same, because the folks who would fall into different trades or whatever within that village, that age group was gone. They were killed in World War One. Well, that's what's happening within Russia, and particularly in the rural areas. And that cannot last forever. That's just not something they can sustain indefinitely, despite what some people think looking at it. Also, don't forget, as Russia's starting to fall apart economically, I think they are in a recession. They say they're going into a recession. I think they're a recession. I think you can't believe the economic numbers that come out of Russia. I think they're so skewed that, and I think they've been skewed for a very long period of time. But what I will say is this, that China is looking at its historic claims on what's essentially, you know, Eastern Russia, the Far East, if you will, Siberia. That used to be China. That was the Tsarist Russia back in the 19th century, took a lot of those areas over. You know, the Treaty of Amur, you know, 1859, 1860. I know it seems like just yesterday. But to China, which has a very long view of things, in their minds, their historic claims on that chunk of terrain that Russia controls up north are probably just as strong, if not stronger, than their claims on taking over Taiwan. The difference is the Taiwanese will fight tooth and nail. The Russians, I don't even know if they're a speed bump for China if they wanted to go north. You know, yes, there's a lot of nuclear weapons. They need to be concerned about that. I don't know if the Russians are really that keen on going into a nuclear war with China or launching nuclear weapons on their own territory, on their own citizens. So there's another thing that's weighing in the background there. Right now, Russia is massing troops and armor and armored vehicles and a lot of capabilities, a lot of UAVs, everything for a big push into the remaining one third of the Donetsk Oblast. That's the two of the what's called the Donbass. You got Luhansk and Donetsk. Donetsk is the one that they don't really control. They're looking at doing this big push. They're pushing right into this belt, this defensive belt around about three major cities that they've never been able to break. And so they're going to do this big push from what it looks like. At least 100,000 troops have been massed, hundreds, potentially thousands. They don't have a whole lot of tanks left, nor a whole lot of infantry fighting vehicles. They've been actually holding back on that for quite some time because they're simply running out. But they are massing armor as well for this big push against this defensive belt that is held strong the whole time. Now, that's a lot of troops. So what does this really mean? Well, it's going to come soon. It's being talked about as a fall offensive. All you got to do is look at the weather, terrain, everything in that part of the world, and you realize they're probably looking about doing this really soon. You know, if it's into October and they haven't started, I would be mildly surprised. I wouldn't rule it out. They got a lot of logistic challenges as well, but it is something that could happen soon. This might be, if it fails, it reminds me of the German counteroffensive against the Allies that had pushed out from Normandy and the famous Battle of the Bulge. And that was where Hitler had massed his troops and his tanks and everything else for this big winter offensive. They hadn't done a winter offensive for a very long time and did this thing that was very, at that time, seen as unpredictable that the Germans would do this, but they did. The thing with the Battle of the Bulge, though, once the German forces were defeated, they were never able to manifest anything quite like that again. They didn't roll over and disappear, but it basically just took the oomph out of the German army in terms of opposing the Allies going across Northern Europe. They just were never able to pull something off like that again. And that's what I'm kind of looking at here. This is where we get into the Clausewitzian sort of approach, which is the decisive battle. I'm wondering if Putin isn't setting up a decisive battle. Now, if he wins, if he was successful and he took that remaining one third of Donetsk Oblast, that really does change the math. That actually poses a difficult situation for Ukraine where they might have to accept a ceasefire where Russia essentially controls the entire Donbass. If Russia controls that area, there are not these big defensive impenetrable, you know, defensive belts that Ukraine has now, and they're opening up their territory to some sort of future war, which will happen. It's guaranteed. You know, if you actually look at Russia's goals in Ukraine, even if they allow Ukraine to exist, they're far bigger than the five provinces or oblasts that they have now. They have a few oblasts that are further in. They want to go all the way out to Odessa, through that area, all the way down to Moldova. They want to push further north. They want to retake Kharkiv Oblast and take Kharkiv, which is the second largest city in Ukraine. They have far bigger goals. And if they take the Donbas in total, they would be poised to kick that off at a future offensive. So that's one of the reasons the Ukrainians feel that this is absolutely critical, and it's a battle they cannot lose. Now, what does this mean? It means if they lose, what happens to the Russian army that's there? This is where it gets interesting. This is not a well-led, well-disciplined, professional army. A lot of conscripts, a lot of folks that just took the money and they're out there and they're dying in droves. Their officers are not very good, and they have them do these really stupid, deadly, dangerous tactics. In many cases, they literally order troops into what is a suicide mission. In some cases, the Russian troops have finally just said to heck with it, turn around, kill their officers, and then surrender to the Ukrainians. Imagine if this big push, to paraphrase, if Putin was a king, all the king's horses and all the king's men were poised on this big push to go into the remaining Donbas, to take Petrovsk, to take that defensive belt north of it, and it completely fails. What does that do to the Russian lines across the board? What does that do to the Russian lines if the Ukrainians were then able to effect a counteroffensive and push through the Russian lines and maybe take a city like Donetsk or something? What does that do? And I'm kind of wondering if they're setting up something like 1917, which is when the Imperial Russian forces, well, actually, technically they're on the Mensheviks at the very end, but that the Russian army basically just kind of gave up on its officers and turned around, killed them, and sort of marched on St. Petersburg and Moscow, and the Bolsheviks built on this, collapse of lines, if you will, and came to power. And Russia was no longer a threat to Imperial Germany. Imperial Germany still lost the war, but Russia pulled out for that reason. And never forget, Lenin was actually a German intelligence operative. Let's not forget that either. I'm kind of wondering what would happen if they were decisively defeated. What could happen? This could really be a decisive battle. It could be something that changes the whole nature of the war. And again, it's not something in the far off distant future. This is something we're seeing right now. They are massing for this big attack right now. The question is, will the Ukrainians be able to hold the line? So Ukrainians don't have to go out there and overwhelm them. They just have to hold the lines and stop the Russians from making a big offensive push. They have to just hold the Russians, and they can give up a little terrain, but they still got to hold the Russians and cause massive attrition. And if they do that, I'm wondering if that would potentially change the complexion of the entire war, especially with the Russian economy spiraling into this massive recession. I'm just kind of wondering what that will do, and the second, third order effects, which is really going to, will the Putin regime remain in power, or will finally be enough is enough within Russia? Certainly amongst the oligarchs, and certainly amongst the mothers of Russia, that they've just simply had enough, and that Russia has shown itself inept, unable, and that Putin takes responsibility for that ineptitude, that loss on the battlefield. And they finally say, I don't know, but I will say this. When things change in Russia, historically speaking, they tend to change very fast. And if you look at what happens in Russia, the Russian Navy was defeated by Japan in 1905. Boom. You had strife on the streets of Moscow and St. Petersburg, and a big change. World War I, again, Russian army keeps getting defeated. Boom. They overthrew it. And of course, some would say that one of the after effects of the big part of it was the one thing that the Russian people or the Soviet people believed in was the power of the Russian military. And then by proxy, the U.S. and its allies just went through that doctrine, the actual material, the tanks, everything else, equipment, everything, tactics, techniques, procedures of the Soviet army by proxy, which was Iraq. During Desert Storm, we went through them like a hot knife through butter, and they didn't stand a chance. And with that, that was pulling the rug out of that last layer of trust or confidence that the Soviet people or the Russian people had in the Soviet system. And that accelerated what actually ended up by the end of 1991. That is one thought. And I'm wondering if they are decisively defeated in this, which is another way of saying the Europeans, and the U.S., but all these countries, and I would point to South Korea and Japan as well, say everyone needs to, if anything, they need to kind of ramp it up a little bit on aid to Ukraine right now to help them hold the lines. Thanks for listening to Strat. Thanks for listening to what I think is becoming a culmination point, but could be a very decisive battle or the decisive battle in the war in Ukraine. And please visit stratpodcast.com. Go to my YouTube page at Hal Kempfer channel. You can go to my website at GRIPSA.com. Thanks for listening, and hopefully you'll listen to the next one.